Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Former Senator Larry Pressler's 2016 book is called Senator Pressler, An Independent Mission to Save Our Democracy. Raised on a farm in South Dakota, Pressler was the first in his family to attend college. He's been a Rhodes Scholar, an officer in the U.S. Army. He served two tours in Vietnam and holds graduate degrees from Oxford, Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and Harvard Law School. He was elected twice to represent South Dakota in the U.S. House of Representatives. In 2014, he ran for the United States Senate in South Dakota as an independent. Senator Pressler, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for your good coverage of our South Dakota issues.
Thank you, sir. I'm just getting started, but it's fun to be here. So let's talk about the book and tell me why you wrote it in the first place. Why have a book at this stage?
Well, I'm now a 74-year-old man. I've had a cancer operation. I have a little sciatic nerve, pinched nerve in my back, but I'm going to overcome both of those little challenges. The point is I won't be around forever, and I decided to write down some things that might be inspirational to some young person. For example, I had a real struggle as a young person on a farm in South Dakota, and I had a childhood stutter that I got speech correction at the University of South Dakota. Finally, we didn't have any speech corrective people in our little high school in Humboldt. But maybe I can inspire some person from a lower middle income background in South Dakota that they can run for office and be successful for a time at least. I got 22 years in Congress, which I'm very grateful to the people of South Dakota, three terms in the Senate and two in the House. So in part, I wanted to write this. Maybe, and in fact, I have gotten letters from two or three young people who've read it and said, well, maybe I've got a chance in our democracy. Hmm. So, and I wanted to tell my story, and I kind of have a mission about that we're in a crisis, and if we're going to preserve our democracy, people are going to have to work much harder at voting, and they're going to have to work much harder at getting prepared to vote.
What is our current crisis, as you see it? Can you narrow that down?
Almost a breakdown of our political institutions. We have a poisonous atmosphere between Republicans and Democrats in Washington, and a lot of basic decisions are not being made. For example, the deficit is growing, and neither side seems to care. And in this campaign, there's only one candidate who's even bothered to offer a budget, and that happens to be Hillary Clinton. But these issues are not even engaged or being discussed. So Washington is in bad shape, in my opinion. Now, but that's because of the apathy of the voters. And my party, the party that I love so much, the Republican Party, I think has fallen into a bizarre state. And that is kind of the reason I ran as an independent. But that is because people are just not studying for whom they vote and why. Hmm. And so few people are participating in primaries. So we've got to have a resurgence of interest and civics, and we're not even teaching civics. I've mainly been a college professor since I left the Senate, and I did not get rich. In fact, I do have my pension and Social Security, but Harriet and I get by, but that is about it. Most former senators get rich by becoming a lobbyist or by somehow cashing in. Sure. on this system we have, which is so hard on our poorer taxpayers.
What happened? How did we get to where we are today in the crisis, as you see it, of just things sort of really getting to the point of breakdown? That's not in our imagination. How did we get here?
Well, I think we got there because of laziness and apathy on the part of all of us in terms of not only voting, a very small number of votes, but preparing to vote, not just listening to negative ads, but to doing some research on candidates and going to some meetings and searching around on the Internet for, and granted, a lot of the information is false. But and then we've all become of the far right or of the far left. I talk to college students about becoming journalists, and they say, well, we don't pay journalists very much, and incidentally, we've lost journalism also, for the most part. In many of the cable TV stations, they're of the right or of the left. I think public radio is struggling to be in the middle, and I admire you for that. and I salute you, and I'm a regular contributor to South Dakota Public Broadcasting over the years, and a small amount, granted, but we seem to have lost our sense of mission as a nation, and we seem to have lost our ethical core, and we shouldn't apologize about praying for our country or whatever, but it is in bad shape, and we could, in some bizarre way, in some of these elections, elect somebody or something bizarre could happen, or the deficit could pile up, and we could lose our money supply, or something like that is going to happen if we keep drifting as we are.
There's a lot at stake, you would say.
Yes. It's our sacred honor and our fortunes of a country. We've been given a very good country. But we now have a huge deficit that's going to have to be paid, or it's going to have to be paid in one form or another. We can't make decisions on agricultural policy or on energy policy. We're dragging behind, and our young people have to take jobs at minimum wages or slightly above minimum wages. We've lost our middle class. I think that Mrs. Clinton, she's the only one that's acknowledged that we're going to have some tax increases on the wealthier and on the estate tax, she says. So that's realistic. All the other candidates just say, oh, we're going to give you tax cuts. Well, you see, that's false advertising, and that should be recognized as such, and people should vote against people who say that. But in our Senate races, people pay very little attention to the issues that they're voting on, and of course, we think of the presidential election more, that's easier to follow. But there are very few people who are really voting on issues. So I'm trying to awake. Part of the purpose of my book is to wake people up. I also advocate in my book that there be national service of some sort for young people. And I also advocate that we take the that anybody who is a lobbyist cannot participate in fundraising, because Washington is sort of a lottery for sale. And in just today's New York Times, they have a major lead article about how think tanks are taking money from special interests, the Brookings Institute and so forth, and issuing reports favorable to those contributors. So what have we got left? What can we believe in? This is really, well, I guess the General Accounting Office still issues straight reports. But we have really reached an intellectual and moral crisis in our nation, and part of the reason I wrote the book was to try to, in my small way, to alert people to that.
Yeah, you mentioned when we first started talking, growing up on a farm in South Dakota. In the book, you know, go into that in greater detail, and the sort of legacy, if you will, of poverty and how it affected your self-esteem growing up. Let's talk a little bit about growing up without means and how that affects kids becoming leaders in the future.
Yes. Well, first of all, South Dakotans have a lower self-esteem than we need to have. I'll say that first in general. For example, they say a young boy who grows up or a girl who grows up on the Minnesota side of the border, they think of themselves as a potential future president of the United States, whereas the boy or girl who grows up on the South Dakota side of the fence 5 miles away, that never enters their mind. So first of all, we have a problem with self-esteem in South Dakota. Our young people, they can do anything but of course it takes work to do it. But mine was compounded. I grew up on a, not poverty, but close to poverty. Yes, it would be defined as poverty. I later learned, I didn't know it at the time, but outdoor toilet, not indoor plumbing. And we didn't have electricity until I was about 7 years old. I discovered later that was classified as poverty. So I did grow up in poverty in South Dakota. On top of that, I had a childhood stutter. I had wonderful parents who worked hard, were very honest. There wasn't any, we thought of ourselves as middle class, but we had a low self-esteem. So I've always had that, I've always felt and I succeeded in going to the University of South Dakota, studying under Dr. Farber and others down there. And I got a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford, England, and I studied there. And then I served in the Army. That really helped my self-esteem a lot. I served in the Vietnam War, but I don't agree. I think I should not have fought that war, but I am a Vietnam veteran. I'm proud of the things that I did. And I'm sorry that Lyndon Johnson didn't tell us the truth all the time.
That experience really changed how you felt about government, didn't it? That you felt not only that that Johnson and Secretary of Defense had lied to the American people, but they had lied to you personally. And that, in the book, you said was sort of transformative as to how you saw government. Tell me about that.
Yes. I guess I could say that, I say to my wife, my time in the military was a waste of time because we lost our war and so forth. On the other hand, to me personally, it was a brutal time of coming to grips with a lot of my fellow Rhodes Scholars opted to continue to take exemptions and so forth, and I could have done that. My father once said to me, he was a wonderful man, and I go to his grave every year and thank him for, he was just a simple farmer, and he didn't want to be anything other than that. And I was anguishing over whether to serve in the Army or not. I could have kept taking exemptions, or I could have even gotten a physical deferment.
Mm-hmm.
But he said to me, well, if you don't do it, that'll mean somebody poorer than you or somebody or some African-American fellow will have to serve in your place, and that might bother you the rest of your life. And so I took my dad's advice, and I signed up and did. It took up 3 years of my life, I was miserable a lot of the time, but it gave me a chance to do some thinking. Now, back in those days, the government, President Johnson and Secretary McNamara, told us we were winning, we were fighting for democracy. I didn't have much information, and it really wasn't my decision anyway. I thought if my country was at war, I should serve. That was my mentality and the mentality of my uncles and so forth who had served in World War II. So we were still out there. We were believers. But then it came to my attention fairly quickly that of course, riding over to Vietnam on the airplane, in those days they had big planes filled with troops. It wasn't like a troop ship.
Mm-hmm.
But they would play us statements from the commander-in-chief, Lyndon Johnson, and later the taped conversations he had with McNamara indicated that both of them were lying to us, and that really shattered me in terms of I had such a deep belief in government just on the face of it.
Mm-hmm.
And but it did a lot for my self-esteem, serving and being a lieutenant in the United States Army. I was the first member of my family to be an officer in the United States Army. We had several, and there's nothing wrong with being an enlisted man in the military. But my brother also served simultaneously in the Air Force. He's now passed away, Dan Presser, a farmer from Humboldt, South Dakota, who died of cancer last year. But both of us were kind of bitter about our military service because the Vietnam veterans were not recognized, and my brother was also a Vietnam veteran who had been exposed to Agent Orange because he was a firefighter and so forth.
Mm.
And I believe he was classified as a Vietnam veteran for some of the locations he was in. I was actually boots on the ground in South Vietnam in the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
So it changed and it gave me enough self-confidence to run for Congress or self-confidence to do something. But it's coming, I guess, and I've just defined this in this conversation for the first time, and when I rewrite, I'm going to try to rewrite the book with it, but in South Dakota, we've got to believe in ourselves a little bit more than we do sometimes. Our state can do it. Our young people can become chemists or lawyers or workers or whatever and do just as well as anybody, but we tend to underrate ourselves a little bit, and I did that. I underrated myself. I think if it weren't for a few coincidences, such as meeting Dr. Farberdow at the University of South Dakota or Dr. Sylvester in the speech correction clinic, I might, I would have done all right, but I probably would have been a high school teacher or something. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a great thing to be. But in terms of trying to achieve, to run for the House and Senate, it takes a great deal of self-confidence. And I didn't always have that. And I've always prayed to God for help, and I don't really think of myself as destined for anything too great, and I'm going to rewrite the book, and I don't really think it's that great a book myself, but it tells the truth.
Why don't you think it's a great book?
Well, there's a lot that I haven't yet expressed that's in me. And,
but it's readable, and it's accessible, and I think that makes it... something that will find an audience. As I read through it, I mean, you can tell there's so much more that, you know, details that you haven't given us. It's a fairly short book, but that also increases its accessibility. And it's, and that seems to be a theme that you have throughout the book and your life, is that people should be able to get to the information.
Yes, well, and I've done some lecturing around some South Dakota colleges, and the students that that have read it have really liked it. Mm-hmm. So, but I didn't mean, I've all, when I said I don't know if it's that great a book, I don't want to put my experiences on such a level that I think that, but I think a person of lower middle income background can see in there an opportunity to serve his country and serve God. And so I hope that that comes through. But the things I did, like, I don't condemn people who didn't serve in Vietnam. Now, there was a big debate. Some people, they made up doctors, or they had doctors to write false certificates, or they were, stayed on in graduate school, or they did something. And we've had presidents who of both parties who, to some extent, have done that. In those days, you could get into the National Guards. The National Guards weren't sent to Vietnam. You can do something to if you are a person of some intellect and means. So my decision to serve, I don't necessarily think that was, somebody might have had an equal amount of courage if they really resisted the draft, because they would say, well, we got the war stopped because we resisted the draft. That's what I'm saying.
Sure. You said my that lifetime, your generation's big problem was and is Vietnam, and I'm just quoting from the preface. It tore us apart emotionally. Do you think that that still exists, that there is in this generation, who many of whom are the leaders of business and in our nation, you think there's still that generational tear?
Yes, there is. To this day, I am resented by some people high who didn't serve, and the only reason they resent me is because I did. Vietnam veterans were never recognized because most of the people who became leaders in industry or journalism or whatever didn't serve, and they did not want to give credit to Vietnam veterans, mm-hmm. and that is the truth. And I kind of resent that, very frankly, and maybe I need to say that a little stronger, more strongly. I'm going to try to revise the book. I don't know how much longer I'll be around. I'm not a prophet of doom. My dad died at 74. I'm 74 and a half. My brother died at 70, but I expect to be around a few more years. But I'm going to take a hand at rewriting it once more so it can be of more service to some of those young South Dakotans who might read it.
I want to talk ask you more questions about this. Do you have time to stick around? We'll take a quick break and then come back to you. Is that all right, sir?
Yes.
All right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to former Senator Larry Presser. We're talking about his book. We'll be right back with more of this conversation in just a minute. Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking now with former Senator Larry Presser. His book is called Senator Presser, An Independent Mission to Save Our Democracy. Let's get back to that conversation. Senator Presser, we were talking about declining moral standards a few minutes ago. You've mentioned a weakening work ethic in this book, an erosion of public integrity, and a waning of the worth of public service. And I'm wondering if you think that's true in South Dakota as well. Are we facing some of the same struggles that the nation is struggling from an ethical and integrity standpoint?
Yes. I think we are in South Dakota. I'd like to see us have a more competitive bipartisan legislature. I think that some of the reforms on the ballot this fall are very would be positive changes. It seems as though that we don't have as much openness in government in South Dakota as we should have. And of course, that's on the state level. I'm mainly a critic at the federal level where I serve. Mm-hmm. But I am a South Dakotan at heart and a South Dakota voter, and a South Dakota is in my thinking every day. Mm-hmm. So we have a situation that our state could have a more competitive two-party system in peer. We could have more openness in our state government, and we have a chance to adopt. I think the Farmers Union has got a matter on the ballot which would make the apportioning the districts mm-hmm. more fair. I believe Rick Noby has got an initiative on the ballot that might make certain of our elections nonpartisan, which might be an improvement. So there are things on the ballot this fall that I think could improve South Dakota state government.
What's the power of an independent voter, an independent candidate? What's the power of the independents?
Well, I get very frustrated. I hope the public will vote for them more. I ran with great hopes of winning a Senate seat as an independent, and indeed I was ahead in the polls, but then both the far right and the far left attacked me. The Republican Party and the Democratic Party attacked me in negative ads in the last week or 10 days of the election, and I lost my lead. And but in part that's because people accept or people believe those negative ads. I think they were about my misspending campaign money way back or something, and I didn't misspend campaign money, but with all sorts of nonsense, and I didn't have enough money to answer those negative ads. But I was disappointed in the public. I thought the public knew me well enough that they wouldn't believe that or they wouldn't follow that. But that is the problem. I think it's voter apathy. People have got to really listen and say, now, is that really true, or can I check that out?
Sure.
Because we'll be just... But it seems like the whole presidential campaign, that's more illustrative, is all negative personal attacks, and that is most unfortunate. Because there are issues such as tax reform that really need to be debated.
With your history with the Republican Party, did becoming independent or even in your words earlier about supporting Hillary Clinton, has that affected your relationships with other Republicans? How has that sort of changed your personal life?
Yes, well, I haven't changed very much. I don't think my philosophy hasn't changed very much. I think my party, the Republican Party, has gone to the right too far for me. But yes, it's amazing how personalized some people take it on both sides. But we've got to recognize that the old Republican Party, I was considered a moderate Republican senator in the late 1970s when I first came to the United States Senate, in the 1980s and in the 1990s. I was always classified as a centrist, sort of a moderate Republican. But they're almost all gone now, and so you have to go way to the right to be accepted in the Republican primaries, and I don't think I could even compete in a Republican primary anymore, because, but strangely enough, some of the issues have changed. Like, I'm very concerned about the deficit, but it's now the Republicans who propose more spending, irresponsible spending. I don't want to go into too much detail here.
Sure.
I sound like I'm criticizing, but I would truly like to vote for a moderate Republican for president and for the Senate and so forth someday again. And I salute, we've just got to reform the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is equally, they have completely given way to the inner city unions, teachers unions, and we just have terrible inner city schools in Chicago and Washington, D.C., and we have people like Mike Bloomberg, who would have been a great president had he run as an independent, or had he run as anything. I think he could have been elected, but for some reason he didn't run. But it's hard to get people to run for these offices because they get just instantly so attacked on the internet and everywhere. And so our best people are not running for the school board or for this or that. Maybe my efforts, my speaking out, will inspire somebody to run for the Senate, House, or the state legislature. We need good people to run for office because elective offices still make most of the determinations, and we're just not getting the right people to run.
I want to make sure that in the book there's also a lot of personal details, not just political. And one of the ones that, of course, gets me excited is books, and you have poetry. And here are a couple poems that have been significant to you. You talk about your experience with the library, an interlibrary loan when you were a youth. Tell me a little bit about your reading life. What do you like to read, and how do you go about finding the next book as a reader and engaging with it?
Well, I'm just finishing a book called Tribe by Sebastian
Younger. I have that one, too. I'm about halfway through that right now. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm a Vietnam veteran. I don't agree with him entirely.
Right.
He sort of has a thesis that when you're in the military, you're in a tribe, and then when you come out, you're not in the tribe anymore. But that's true of high school or college or lots of things. So I'm not really, I don't think he's really defined PTSD. I've got some post-traumatic stress disorder from Vietnam. And it's not because I don't feel I'm a member of the tribe anymore. It's because I saw and heard some terrible things. But it's a good effort at trying to define this lost generation almost, the Vietnam veteran, the Vietnam era, and the Vietnam people who were not veterans, but were just the women who paid the taxes, stayed home, and the men who resisted the draft because they felt it was a wrong war. I salute their courage. I don't even mind if somebody moved to Canada to avoid the draft. Now, if they did that out of conviction that they didn't agree with the Vietnam War and so forth. So, but it's such a mixed up generation. We just have so many, and just talking about it right now, I feel almost irresponsible because I'm not giving you real clear guidelines. But I feel good about myself. But yeah. So I'm reading that. But when I was a youth on the farm, I used to write to Mercedes McKay, who is a state librarian. I finally met her years later. And you could get books sent free of postage, and I would get books. And I got in trouble with the local Catholic priest. I was raised as a Catholic, and I got some books on the bad popes. And I'm not picking on the Catholic Church now, but God Almighty, did I get chewed out about having a book. My mother reported me to the local priest. I'd gotten a book about it. But it was a history of the popes, and some of them were bad, believe it or not. Most of them are very good. So I'm not anti-Catholic at all, and that'll always be a part of me. But
you left the Catholic Church as well.
Well,
you're no longer a practicing Catholic, is that right? And you,
well,
I read in the book that
sometimes. I'm a little bit of everything. I'm mostly a Mormon these days because the Mormons offer the non-alcoholic work solution to our problems on Pine Ridge and elsewhere. They're the only solution to the deep problems we have there is the example is the non-alcoholic work is prayer. And that is what I have come to believe, and so that's a local charitable thing. But it's not any doctrinal dispute, or I don't disagree with the hierarchy of this church or that church.
And you were interested in the teachings of Confucius because of his call for service.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And service is the trick, and we've got to. That's another problem we have to work on in South Dakota: our Native American reservations and. It sounds prejudiced to some to say it, but they are more susceptible to problems of alcohol and certain diseases. And we can't require it, but we should be recommending to all races a non-alcoholic work is prayer approach to life. And that, I think, will solve some of the problems. Now, a lot of people won't accept that, but we have to put that out there as an example.
Senator Pressler, we're going to have to leave it there. The book is called Senator Pressler, An Independent Mission to Save Our Democracy. Sir, we appreciate you giving us so much time today. The book is definitely one to read. I highly recommend it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.